are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, May 3rd, 2018. My name is Michael Brooks on a Michael Thursday. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Gabriel DeBenedetti from New York Magazine. We're talking about, how Bernie Sanders is quietly building a digital media empire, its implications for a possible run in 2020, and for the cause of left politics and independent media. Rudy Giuliani doesn't seem to be helping. We'll get to that. The White House has replaced one of its attorneys with an attorney for Bill Clinton during his investigations. Iowa legislators have just passed one of the most restrictive abortion reproductive violation laws in the country. A new Democratic aligned group is hoping that Democrats will play the same game that Republicans did to block the seating of Justice Garland. And Democrats are bullish on winning the House in 2018. But Nancy Pelosi as Speaker, not so sure about that. Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif says that Iran will not renegotiate the nuclear deal. And Bibi Netanyahu is promising new documents from the disco era that will explain why we should get out of it. I'm just kidding on that one. Ex-lobbyist claims that foreign governments help plan Pruitt trip to Australia as the cascade of allegations and conflicts of interest accusations and stories about Pruitt continue at a rapid pace. And Cambridge Analytica has filed for bankruptcy. Simple data points there as their business vanishes. And the United States has released its first Guantanamo detainee and sent him to Saudi Arabia, the first in the Trump era. And the United States has returned smuggled Hobby Lobby artifacts back to Iraq. It's a bizarre story. Just one of the many smaller crimes out of the massive crimes that we have committed against that country. Thank you. So we're here. It's a full team. Minus hello, obviously. Matt is here. Jamie's here. Brendan is here. Good day to all.
Good day.
So I'm perfectly honest. I really haven't followed. I haven't watched any of Stormy Daniels' interviews in full. The biggest interesting sort of data point for me in this whole Stormy Daniels thing is obviously new Ivanka material. But I've always held out, you know, two things. I mean, one is that, yeah, it's pretty funny. And two, there is the, I think, very small, and people are still maybe overly excited about this, but there is like an Al Capone scenario here where this is the relatively marginal thing that nets Trump. Now, I would say the chances of that are like infinitesimal, but it is a real thing and it is happening. Rudy Giuliani has emerged from his crypt, and he was on last night with Sean Hannity, and he is not helping.
Having something to do with paying some Stormy Daniels woman $130,000, I mean, which is going to turn out to be perfectly legal. That money was not campaign money. Sorry, I'm giving you a fact now that you don't know. It's not campaign money. No campaign finance violation.
So they funneled it through the law firm.
Funneled through the law firm, and the president repaid it.
Oh, I didn't know he did. Yeah. There's no campaign finance law.
Zero.
So the president...
Just like every... Sean...
So this decision, Sean, was made by...
Everybody was nervous about this from the very beginning. I wasn't. I knew how much money Donald Trump put into that campaign. I said, $130,000. He's going to do a couple of checks for $130,000. When I heard Cohen's retainer of $35,000, when he was doing no work for the president, I said, but that's how he's repaying. That's how, how he's repaying it, with a little profit and a little margin for paying taxes for Michael.
But do you know the president didn't know about this? I believe that's what
he didn't
Michael
know about
said.
The specifics of it. As far as I know. But he did know about the general arrangement that Michael would take care of things like this, like I take care of things like this for my clients.
Well, I believe the last part. I'm sure that all of these people have taken care of a lot of things for their clients. Working it backwards, it's very funny to see Sean Hannity, who is a foreclosure profiteer and very successful media propagandist, but has a very, 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 very limited intellectual bandwidth, and getting confronted with new information, which even he can kind of see, like, you say it sounds, it's totally kosher, but it doesn't sound kosher because it contradicts every single thing that Michael Cohen and Donald Trump have said about this, including Donald Trump a couple of months ago on Air Force One saying he knew nothing about it and he didn't do it and there was no money from him. And you'd have to ask Michael Cohen. And that was where Giuliani was like, hey, well, I mean, you know, first of all, as I think it was Brendan pointed out, paid in installments, which is interesting move for a self-proclaimed billionaire. And yeah, no, he just might not have known the specific details of a porn star getting paid off.
But he is turning over the tables in the swamp.
I mean, and also that so basically... I mean, I could see, I guess the legal angle they'll pursue is that there was no contribution. This is a private matter. This isn't campaign money. I mean, it's obvious the case they're setting up here. But, I mean, you could just, I think Michael Aventi or whoever that guy is who represents Stormy Daniels is like, well, no, in reality, this is a campaign contribution. Literally, like, this contribution from Michael Cohen to pay off Stormy Daniels benefits Donald Trump's campaign. And then, in Giuliani's words, he funneled money back to him, which is a great word choice. You know, if I ever have a consigliere on national television saying that I didn't commit financial wrongdoing, I definitely want them to use the phrase funneled money through, because that really zeroes in on the fact that there obviously was no financial misdeeds here.
Dude, funneling rules.
Funneling does a rule. I agree with that, but I don't know if it's the word choice that you want from your attorney who's saying that you didn't do anything on national television. Even Sean Hannity was able to grasp that.
That's a good gig if you're Michael Cohen, right? You just sit on your ass and write checks to porn stars and then get paid back a small profit over time?
I mean, I think that would be the best explanation of understanding the type of law that Michael Cohen could possibly practice if you've ever seen him do a television interview.
It's classic law school stuff.
Classic Michael Cohen.
I think the most surprising thing in all this is that he actually got paid back.
I am shocked. That should Trump should come out and be like, by the way, everybody says I don't honor my contracts. I don't pay people back. Well, guess what? We even put in tax money. That's how above the board we were with this money funneling arrangement. What's this? Michael.
There's a Rolling Stone article that going into some of Michael Cohen's like, former associates.
Okay, so this is another Michael Cohen example of Michael Cohen's legal work. Michael Cohen represented guys who took turns renting U-Hauls and, after obtaining insurance coverage, plowed them into vehicles occupied by friends in order to file bogus injury claims. This is like
this is a Ralph Cifaretto plot line.
Except it would be like it's like a Ralph Cifaretto plot line that Tony put an end to, and now they're having a summit who is the guy who smokes all the time's house? Oh, I forget the guy's name. But like, all right, you need to meet with Ralph, Tone, and we're gonna figure this out. He's having fucking U-Haul trucks plowing the people in the middle of fucking Teaneck. And he still isn't earning back. That guy's a fucking problem. Tone, it was his idea. You know that Ralph's very creative.
He's our best earner,
He's
Tone.
Our best
earner.
He's a fucking moron.
There's some more here if you want to read this part.
Okay. Is that literally a name? Pizza Grillo?
Isn't Grillo.
Pizza Grillo.
But later down here.
McFarland. Oh, not the part that's highlighted.
That name is a microaggression.
Wait, they're basically being crashed test dummies in each collision, Jackson says. The U-Haul ring submitted more than $350,000 in fraudulent personal injury claims before they were caught. Both Pizza Grillo and McFarland pleaded guilty to third-degree insurance fraud, and Cohen's lawsuit was withdrawn. Pizza Grillo did not respond to a message seeking comment. You know... And this is the other amazing thing, is that also Michael Cohen's, I don't know if it's his former father-in-law or still father-in-law, was also involved in like some type of like taxi cab crimes or something. Michael Cohen, I said this before in relation to the Felix Sater speculation, it is shocking when you look at this guy's career and the amount of like criminal things he's been intimately entwined with and the fact that he hasn't ever faced charges. Makes me speculate as to some other possible things that Michael Cohen might be doing in terms of certain types of people he might be talking to and giving information to, as an example.
Not following you.
I don't get it. I totally. You know, what's funny is it's like this, in some ways, this is the perfect distillation. Like, for the Bushes or the Obama or the Clinton administration, you'll say, like, oh, well, you know, this attorney, or, you know, Jim Baker was like in bed with the Saudis for everything, or Eric Holder represented predatory Wall Street firms. And the distinction with Trump is it's like he's trying to work his way up there, but he got to start with the U-Haul guys.
Imagine crashing a U-Haul into your buddy's like SUV and be like, this is going to be fucking awesome. I'm going to T-bone you this time.
Yeah, I think, yeah, right, exactly. And she's like, you're just like, and then you like visit him in the hospital. You're like, living the dream.
They're wearing like football uniforms in the car.
It's like, oh.
Neck brace on for the rest of the season.
I don't want to be. Why do I always have to be the one that gets crashed into? It's bullshit. They're out of fucking control.
That's how you know who your friends are.
Yeah, that's exactly how you know your
friends
are. Would
you trust them to crash a U-Haul into you?
All right. But now we're going to be talking about a very, very controversial politician who the resistance types have also focused a lot of energy on for doing really controversial things like advocating for expanding Social Security and wearing warm winter coats. We're talking about Bernie Sanders' independent media empire with Gabriel DeBenedetti. Right back on the Majority Report.
You know what I'm saying? It's all good, baby, baby. It was all a dream. I used to read Word Up magazine. Salt and pepper and Heavy D up in the limousine. Hanging pictures on my wall. Every Saturday, Rap Attack, Mr. Magic, Molly Mall. I let my tape rock till my tape pop. Sipping on private stock way back when I had the red and black lumberjack with the hat to match. Remember rapping Duke? Da-ha, you never thought that hip-hop would take it this far. Now I'm in the limelight cause I rhyme tight. Time to get paid, blow up like the World Trade. Born sinner, the opposite of a winner. Remember when I used to eat sardines for dinner? Peace to Raw G, Brucey B, Kid Capri. Funk, Master Flex, Love Bug, Star Ski. I'm blowing up like you thought I would. Call a crib, same number, same hood.
Welcome back, Michael Brooks on the Majority Report. Joining us now is Gabriel DeBenedetti. He is the national correspondent for New York Magazine and author of Bernie Sanders is Quietly Building a Digital Media Empire. Gabriel, thanks for being here.
Oh, thanks so much.
So I think a lot of us, and I'm sure particularly people who watch and listen to the show, have caught different pieces of Bernie content over the last several months, whether it's a streamed YouTube town hall, on inequality, whether it's an explainer video on everything from the inequities in the tax code to why we need to, you know, preserve the Iran deal as an example. But you actually kind of map out that there's a real strategy here that in some ways is sort of could be harnessed both certainly for a presidential run, but is also actually getting to some of Bernie Sanders' sort of deepest desires as a politician and concerns about corporate media that go back to his start in politics as a, you know, as a, as an independent candidate in the 1970s.
Yeah, that's definitely, that's exactly right. I mean, we don't know yet if how much of the, what he's doing now is geared towards 2020. And in fact, he says none of it is geared towards 2020, and we'll talk about all that later, he says. Yeah. But he has certainly been trying to find an alternative to the mainstream media for 40 years. He, you know, going back to when he was first running for mayor, he's been talking about in Burlington, he's been talking about the problems with the corporate mainstream media. When he first ran for re-election, he did it by, he announced it by printing out his own fake newspaper that he, you know, distributed around town. And after that, he had his own radio show, his own TV show, a few versions of his own TV show. Essentially, the idea here is that he's been trying to figure out ways to connect directly with voters for ages. This is one of the things that he thinks about most, and it's not a surprise to anyone who's heard him give his standard stump speech. But what's interesting now is that he does has this operation in his Senate office. It's just three staffers and three interns, but they're
paid interns, as you point out.
Paid interns.
Yeah,
that's right.
Yep.
But they're cranking out these videos nonstop. In 2017, they put out over 500 videos. And some of these, as you say, are these live streams. And when he does these live streams, he's been getting more viewers than CNN at the same time. So it's really something that's quite remarkable that a lot of folks on Capitol Hill didn't even realize was happening until I published this story. I got a lot of people reach out to me and say, I had no idea, because he doesn't do a particular, he's not particularly aggressive about promoting this. He's essentially just, you know, showing it to his own backers and anyone that goes, that stumbles upon his Facebook page.
Yeah, so, but at the same time, the numbers are astonishing. And I mean, obviously people know by now you'd have to be really, you know, disconnected from political reality. He obviously has a lot of backers and he ran a very strong race in 2016. But do you get the sense that this reception, I mean, obviously there's already a built-in constituency for him and they're sort of, you know, attempting to broaden out through things like Our Revolution and support different kinds of candidates. But at the same time, he's getting into this, you know, algorithm-driven, very distinct media space that a lot of people, obviously, in traditional media and politics don't particularly understand. I think also a fair amount of us kind of navigating this space don't entirely understand it either because some of the methodology is pretty opaque behind it. But do you get a sense that he might also be tapping into, you know, new people actually sort of, you know, starting the process that he started so late in 2016, potentially earlier, and I guess not to frame it inside 2020, but just in terms of like a kind of broader outreach and exposure to new sets of potential constituents and voters for, you know, the agenda he pushes writ large, even regardless of 2020.
Yeah, that's something that I asked him about directly when I.
Hello? Gabriel, I think we'll just call him right back. I'm not really sure what happened there. All right.
This album is dedicated to all the teachers that told me I'll never amount to nothing. To all the people that lived above the buildings that I was hustling from that called the police on me when I was just trying to make some money to feed my daughter. And all the struggle, you know what I'm saying? It's all good, baby, baby. It was all a dream. I used to read word of-
yeah, a little more Biggie Never Hurt Anybody. Gabriel, you were saying, go ahead.
I am here. Yes. Sorry about that.
Well, no problem.
What I was saying is this is something that I talked to Senator Sanders about. I asked him specifically when we were talking about this project of his, you know, whether he's reaching out to people. And his answer is sort of that he's always reaching out to more people and that this is not specifically a strategy to find new voters for any particular election. But, you know, I talked to a lot of his staffers who've been working with him for a very long time. And what he has always said is that he does have an ambition to create something, some sort of alternative news network that just talks about policy and reaches the biggest possible audience, bigger than the New York Times if possible. That's what he's always compared himself to. And if that includes reaching out to new people and getting new people on board, that's great. But that's not his primary primary interest right now. What he's trying to do is figure out ways to build this as broadly as possible. But as I said, he's not really promoting this in any way, although sometimes he does do, you know, he will work together with other alternative news networks and try and get some other people to pay attention here. But for now, he's not focused on, for example, building his campaign list or anything like that. And it's important to note that a lot of this is being done within his Senate office. It's not part of his campaign team, which, of course, is still up and running. And when you ask him about the political side of it, he sort of gets a bit frustrated. He sees those as two different issues because, of course, this is something that he's been trying to do for years. And the campaign is also something that he's been trying to do for a long time, but it's different.
Do you think that it's also striking when he talks about it, is that he sort of has two parts of his critique. There's the stuff that, you know, I think everybody would expect, like, why isn't media talking about the most important issues? Why aren't they talking about, you know, climate, poverty, inequality, sure, banks, healthcare, you know, the policy. But he also seems, and you kind of alluded to it there, he also almost has this other sort of like, you know, like back in my day, we could have long conversations about things, you know, like kind of a critique of the medium too. I mean, does that make sense?
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. He's, you know, anyone who's heard one of his stump speeches on a campaign trail, or really what he's been saying pretty consistently for decades, knows that he's no fan of the modern media and the modern, what he has called the modern media since the 1970s. But, you know, one of his central critiques is essentially not just that, you know, the news shows don't, as you say, talk about the central issues. And he thinks that has a lot to do with advertisers and with the fact they're run by corporations with their own bottom lines. But the other side of it is he just doesn't like the format, you know. And so on these videos that he puts out, a whole lot of them don't have him at all in them. It's primarily real people. And there's very little talk about, you know, there's almost no talk about Robert Mueller or the Russia investigation or anything like that. It's basically all about policy. And that's because he doesn't like these talking heads. And, you know, very importantly here, let's not pretend that this is a straight ahead news show. Of course, it is his point of view. So it's not as if there's much room for dissent from that either.
Yeah, of course. He also speaks about his sort of frustration with that specifically. And I'm wondering if maybe, you know, again, it's an outlier poll, so I wouldn't get sort of overly freaked out about it. But there is this new, you know, millennials drifting away from Democrats poll. And again, I mean, the first thing to say is it's an outlier and overall the numbers don't reflect that, particularly with millennials. But if one had to speculate, at least me, I would speculate part of the reason might be that if the kind of primary identification of Democrats in media is just this sort of one-track obsession with, I mean, not only Russia and Mueller, but just any type of Trump whatever, you know, at the expense of everything else. Does he speak to that directly? And how does he balance, and maybe he's not trying to balance, but how does he balance both the needed critique of, like, as an example, you know, MSNBC, it's just Russia, 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 Stormy Daniels, Russia, and we need to talk about, you know, some actual things too. How does he balance that at the same time was also, you know, part of the people he is talking to are, you know, obviously, I mean, Democrats who really do hate and are kind of uniquely disturbed by Donald Trump. How does he kind of thread that? Has he threaded that needle by trying to, like, bring those worlds together at all? Like, even if we looked at something like Trump and Russia, maybe we could look at, you know, international money laundering and tax havens and, you know, how that fits with the inequality narrative. Is that what he's doing?
It's more or less that, yeah. I mean, I think, as I said earlier, it's important to remember that the way that this is happening is it's essentially a lot of these are really press releases in video form. This is just his way of opining on the news often. And what he does very frequently is he will not talk about investigations, whether it's Mueller or Stormy Daniels or anything like that. But exactly what you just said, he'll talk about tax havens or he will talk about foreign policy issues. So there is a lot of Trump talk on this Bernie TV, but it's very, very closely targeted so he can make a broader point about policy. He doesn't certainly say anything positive about Donald Trump, but he's not really talking about the news that, you know, you would think would be the top story of the day if you're watching cable news or reading the big newspapers every morning. And his argument is basically like, listen, I just want to talk about policy. And if Trump gives me an opportunity to do that, I'll do it. But the reason that Trump is bad is not because of Mueller.
Do you think his it's that in the same way in 2016 that some of the same reasons that maybe people who you know, look at the sort of horse race stuff and would kind of say like, oh, you know, he's gruff and his suits are rumpled and blah, blah, blah. And actually in the environment of 2016, it sort of worked in his favor that he was kind of like this, you know, sort of unapologetic, kind of no nonsense, you know, kind of like gruff grandpa that's looking out for you kind of thing. Do you think that that also fits the specific mediums that he's playing? Like, you know, that people who are looking to YouTube and podcasting and everything, that the it's a bit more, you know, it's, I guess the simplest way is it's not as polished.
Exactly. It's definitely, yeah. It's very informal. And that is an important thing that he likes to focus on. I mean, obviously these videos are pretty well produced for the most part, right. But they're clearly produced quickly. They're not, you know, cable news segments or certainly documentary type things. And I think that informality and that level of direct connection to real people who are watching it is exactly what he's going for. You know, it doesn't necessarily work if you're trying to win over people in a long political argument and they want to see polished, you know, polished arguments in front of them. But it certainly does work if you're, you know, if you're trying to go viral or if you're just trying to reach out to your voters and quickly explain what you need to get across to them. And again, that's basically what he's doing here. He's not trying to create, you know, Oscar-winning documentaries.
From the perspective of other you know, people in Washington, other political figures. I mean, I know he's done some of these things with Elizabeth Warren. And it was kind of shocking to me that you said that most people were not, you know, following this, because it would seem to me that whether you were, you know, interested in building up your own personal brand and disseminating a direct relationship with constituents, and in fact, if you are serious about, you know, a national run, these are exactly the types of mediums you need to be looking into. I get, are there people in the Senate and Washington really not following this? I mean, and sort of, you know, attempting to think about how it could apply to them.
I think every single one of the people who might run for president in 2020 understands that they're likely going to have to do something like this in order to reach out to people directly. But one of the reasons that folks are not necessarily aware of what Bernie is doing is that he rarely works directly with other Senate offices on things like this. You know, he's obviously a go-it-alone kind of guy. And so a lot of people who work in other Senate offices or other senators sort of said to me, you know, the reason that we didn't know this was happening is that he never told us it was happening. And obviously these are not people who sort of just pop over to his Facebook page every day to see what he's updating. So because there's no broader dissemination of these videos in a sort of concerted way, these people just didn't know that this was happening at all. And you did mention that, you know, he did do that one event with Senator Warren, and that's certainly true. But that was a sort of one-off invited event. It's not as if he's made a practice of appearing with other senators. And it's interesting because this is something that other senators would love to sort of jump in on, but a lot of them aren't necessarily working with Sanders on a day-to-day basis on a lot of these policies, so they haven't had the opportunity to. That there's reason to believe that might change, especially as 2020 comes into focus, and whether he runs or not, he's going to play a particularly big role in it.
Right.
But to the other part of the question here, you know, someone who is I quote in the story, Brian Fallon, who was Hillary Clinton's press secretary, and he said, listen, no matter what, in 2020, if you run for president, you're going to have a production team like this on your communication shop, because this is very clearly the best way to reach out to people.
There's no doubt about that. What has struck me in this profile is that, you know, everything that Bernie is saying about cable news and the influence of, you know, media monopolies and advertisers and the sort of dumbed down format. I mean, I think, you know, all of these criticisms certainly make a lot of sense to me and my sort of, you know, analysis. And I think clearly to a lot of people. And obviously, you know, YouTube and podcasting and social networks and platforms, and as much as we might criticize them for any number of things, have obviously opened up the door for precisely this type of thing that he's doing, which, you know, I just think isn't sort of, especially just on the policy end, it's not debatable that it's an improvement to have an outlet where somebody can, you know, directly make the case in a more detailed and specific way about things that actually really matter. And to some extent, that's ideologically neutral. You know, I mean, presumably somebody on the right or in the center, I might have a question about you know, the methodology and how much of a base there is, particularly for a centrist message, actually, in this type of medium. But, you know, the more the better, people trying to communicate in these formats and get more detailed. But it also was interesting because it seems like just as he's sort of finally finding his way around the traditional media monopolies that he's been fighting his whole career, he's taking advantage of these Silicon Valley platforms, which bring their own tremendously dangerous implications for privacy, and also obviously are tremendously monopolistic in and of themselves.
Absolutely.
How is that in the analysis at all? Is he thinking about that?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think the short answer is he's using the technology that's most available and the easiest and best technology to do that. And right now, what he's using primarily over everything else is Facebook and Facebook
right.
Live.
Right.
But the day that I sat down with him was the day that Mark Zuckerberg was testifying in the Senate. And there, you know, every TV in Sanders' Senate office was showing Zuckerberg's testimony. And I asked him about it. And he essentially said he's extremely worried about these privacy issues, but there's not really a good, and there are a lot of questions that Zuckerberg still has to answer, but there's not really a good answer to the overall question here, because as it currently stands, Facebook certainly is the best way for him to reach this big audience. Now, he does use Twitter, he does use YouTube, but there aren't a ton of other ways of directly connecting with people, and that is something that he's grappling with.
And they certainly, I mean, you know, it's not like, yeah, of course. I mean, Google and Twitter, I mean, it, you know, it's not just Facebook. I mean, Twitter, just as an example, updated their, you know, privacy regulations in an incredibly invasive fashion. What are the most popular videos? Like, what are people particularly, or podcasts, or, you know, he sat down with everybody, I think, from Bill Nye to Al Gore to, you know, done an explainer on why John Bolton is so uniquely threatening. I mean, what are people most strongly responding to?
The most popular video by far is one where he highlights the work of essentially the Canadian healthcare system, and he shows what happens when a Canadian doctor came to the Capitol and talked to senators about that system. You know, it's part of his overall push on single payer healthcare. Other popular videos, though, include more or less things that are anti-Trump, you know, and that sort of speaks to the broader question here of whether this is a broader Democratic thing or a broader progressive thing or just a Sanders thing. But basically, the videos that have done well, in addition to the Canadian one, include videos that about him, for example, that outline, for example, the women's march and things like that, and videos around Trump's inauguration. But other than that, of course, he does do interviews with a number of people, as you said, Bill Nye, Al Gore, Bill de Blasio. And you know, in addition to that, he has done a few live streams. So he has the one with Senator Warren, which was extremely popular. It drew millions of people that night. So it's a pretty wide variety, and people tend to tune into the ones that are either about healthcare, because that's an issue that he's widely known for, or about Donald Trump.
From the future, from a broader kind of future of political advertising and strategy perspective, this is really interesting because, you know, consultants have for a long time have been sort of, I mean, they're admitting the declining importance of television advertising, even though they, you know, they certainly don't want that gravy train to go away, because that's still an incredible amount of money for those ad buys. And obviously that's another bottom line interest of the cable and television industry. But it seems that the consultants kind of go in two different directions with, you know, the sort of transitioning out of television. And one is that, you know, maybe not, I mean, Cambridge Analytica had very questionable methodology too. But, you know, one end is it's all about these incredibly micro-targeted, you know, mini experiences. And you can have, you know, some people think you still need to make really elaborate ads and you know, productions that are sort of aimed on Facebook or Twitter or Instagram. Other people think, no, you can actually basically, and actually the Trump campaign did this. They had incredibly cheap production, rudimentary ads mostly. And then on the other hand, I mean, it seems like the Sanders direction is actually like, you know, political advertising is almost going to have to be like, you know, public access programming. I mean, where, you know, what do you think the implications are for how strategists think about campaigns in general and what advertising and communication even is, and how big a line there is between that and policy?
Well, there's a huge question about, you know, what this is going to look like moving forward. I think Sanders certainly is someone who tried very hard to be innovative when it came to digital outreach during his 2016 campaign. But the reality is that his television ads and spending on television consultants were a huge, huge, huge part of his expenditures and a part of the reason that he was able to, you know, scale up so quickly and get so many people to pay attention to him. So in the future, people are certainly, and this has been the case for the last few election cycles, experimenting with new ways to micro-target, experimenting with new ways to directly reach voters. But I think the implication of your, or one of the implications of your question is a totally fair one, which is, you know, there will certainly be a further divergence of regular campaign rallies and just advertisements. People will be aiming to live stream everything, and they will be paying for people to see that. So there will be, you know, the technology of politics is changing nonstop. There's no doubt that the 2020 campaign in particular, when Democrats will be especially desperate to beat the incumbent president, we're going to see all sorts of interesting experimentation along those lines.
Related to that, the other thing that Bernie is obviously very intent about, but even, you know, was actually a very important part of Barack Obama's wins, was actually synchronizing, you know, micro-targeting and television efforts with really activating door-to-door. And one of the major failings of the Clinton campaign was sort of letting that lapse and thinking that kind of analytics could take care of it in of itself. Does he have a sense of how this translates into, you know, clearly what he wants, which is sort of empowering people to take action in their, you know, local, state, and national issues? Does he have a, is there a kind of sense of how that funnels, or is it just, you know, well, yeah, go ahead.
Well, I mean, let's be clear that Sanders is certainly doing this video operation and this media operation, but he's also got other things going on. He's got his Our Revolution political group. Right. He is doing rallies for other Democrats all around the country, for other candidates all over the country. So I think the answer to your question is he's certainly doing a lot of these things, and he's clearly still considering running for president in 2020. Right. And considering what his political future looks like. And yes, of course, he's going to want to continue to empower people all around the country. And that's one of the reasons that they launched Our Revolution after the 2016 campaign, so that they could have an outreach all over the country. But the reality is, you know, those are two different sides of his overall operation here. And when you ask him, you know, how is what you're doing now going to translate into 2020, he sort of says that's not how we think about this. And it's true. Yeah. This is something that he's thought about for a very long time, and not in the context of eventually running for president.
Final question. What does he have planned? I mean, did he give you a sense of, like, is it going to sort of steady state? Is this going to be scaled up? I'm not talking about 2020, but just the media operation specifically.
Sure.
Like, even sure. Just like as a content planner, what does he have moving forward?
Yeah, he essentially said, listen, this is working well and we're going to continue to do it, but that he was also going to continue to try and improve it in any way he can, continue to try and experiment with new ways of reaching people, new kinds of video production. Again, this is something that he's been trying to do for 40 years now. So the idea that he would just say, oh, well, you know, the technology works now, so let's stick with this one, doesn't really jive with how he's been doing things in the past. But I think what we'll see a lot more of is perhaps the live streams, because every time that he's done those, they've had enormous audiences. And now that he's likely to be out on the campaign trail more in 2018, campaigning for other people, it's likely that you're going to see more and more of those rallies live streamed. And, you know, that's something that we saw during the 2016 campaign. But obviously, things have changed a little bit since then.
Actually, I take that back. The actual final question. He's done a few of these town halls with CNN. Did you talk to any people in that traditional, you know, in that corporate media space, and did they have any sense of, like, wow, we got to give him even more time, or at the very least start thinking about covering, you know, poverty or Medicare for All a little bit, just even from that same, you know, get eyeballs market perspective that he criticizes?
I think there are two answers to this. First answer is sure, yes, they're monitoring this and they're aware of what he's doing. But of course, there's huge hesitance to sort of all of a sudden do a town hall on just on a policy issue or something like that, because of course that's not something that's been in the traditional corporate media wheelhouse. So I think there's a lot of foot dragging, but these folks are also watching what he's doing very closely, because as you know, he is invited on CNN and MSNBC all the time, and they're aware of his sort of power as a messenger. So they are certainly studying what he's up to. And I don't think they think that it's any coincidence at all that a number of his staffers are former network employees, because they see another way of doing this stuff.
Gabriel DeBenedetti, national correspondent for the New York Magazine. We'll have links to all of your info on majority.fm. I really appreciate your time, man.
Thank you.
Thanks so much. All right, folks. We are going to get to the fun half where we officially join forces with Alex Jones. No, it's fun. It is sort of like I enjoy scumbag on scumbag violence, but in this case, I really do have a scumbag preference, and I make no bones about it. I think it's clear who we like better.
I'm pretty sure it's unanimous, actually.
Yeah, I think it's unanimous. I think that if you are coming out the wrong side of this fight, I actually have to question you as an ally. Become a member of the Majority Report today, majority.fm/become a member. JustCoffee.coop, get the Majority Report blend. Leave the Majority Report a review on iTunes. Subscribe to the YouTube page if you haven't already. How are we doing on YouTube? We're very healthy numbers
we're
there
hitting,
now.
We're almost at 1,600 live viewers, which is just, that's about double where we were when I started at this show.
And how many subscribers?
Oh, 270,000.
Sweet. And of course, that way you can watch the live show, all of our clips. You can watch Michael Brooks' show live. It's a very active channel. Check out my show, patreon.com/TMBS. Check out what's going on. How new Intifada?
Newish.
Newish? Well, whatever.
Yeah. We got Ross Wolf of Left Book fame. We talk about left communism. We talk about various fights that Sean's gotten in. It's fun.
Nice. I dig it. Check out all of these things and see you on the flip side.
You are in for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun. Total
pussy. Total pussy. 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 Pussy.